The Theosophical Society take pleasure in introducing Mrs. Radha Bernier, the President of the Theosophical Society, an international lecturer and Sanskrit scholar, in a lecture entitled Self and Suffering. This was given in Auckland on the 19th of March 1985.
As anyone can notice, infinite beauty upon this earth and in the universe. There is the beauty of the trees, the rivers, the birds, the sky, stars and flowers, innumerable aspects of nature. But there is not only the beauty of all these things, but the beauty of growth, the growth of the seed into the shoot, into a multi-branched and mighty tree, its flowering and propagation. There is great beauty in all that, in the migration of birds, in the building of nests by birds, which are so skillful that they can weave and stitch, decorate, and do many other things. There is the beauty of such a complex thing as the human body, with all its marvelous sensitive organs functioning perfectly together, synchronized better than what a computer can do. There is the beauty of the human brain. There is a variety and a boundless creativity in nature, in all of which there is beauty. But in the midst of it all, there is great suffering. Human life is rarely exempt from suffering. For a short time, each one may think that he has escaped or escaped the worst. Each one seizes a little bit of joy, a little bit of comfort where he can. But suffering may be around the corner. Someone may die or get separated in some way. And suffering exists in multifarious forms. There is not only the suffering of caused by wars, by the loss of property, by the loss of a beloved one, the pangs of total separation, as it seems, caused by death, But apart from that, there is the suffering which is the part, which is part of the daily agitation of life. Struggle and constant struggle is the lot of many people. Struggling not only for gaining their livelihood, which people have to do over large parts of the earth, trying to gain every scrap they can, but struggling to go ahead, which involves tremendous stress, anxiety, worries. And there is suffering in the form of loneliness, of despair, frustrated hope or ambition, the tensions between wife and husband, parents and children, one wanting something and the other refusing to go along. Daily friction. All this is part of suffering, because where there is lack of peace, lack of stability within the innermost part of oneself, when there is agitation and distraction, the feeling of being pressurized, it's all part of the turmoil which can be included in the general term suffering. Man has always lived like this. From the beginning of time, wars, cruelties, hope, despair, all this has been part of human life, remaining unchanged. And very few people ask the question, is it necessary that human beings should live like this? Of course, there is the occasional suffering caused by natural disasters, cyclones or floods, whatever it may be. But such suffering is only a very small part of the total suffering of man. Most of it is created by his own way of living, by his activities and organization, by his concepts and ideas concerning relationships. War is the creation of man. It is not necessary to be at war. There is so much knowledge, technical power in the present day that all can share and be happy. It is not necessary that millions of people should live in poverty or die of hunger. Those who are capable of doing such extraordinary things as probing distant planets and stars, creating wonderful electronic instruments, they can surely solve the problem of poverty and hunger if they want to. So it is not something in nature, but it is the work of man. And it has always been so. The conquest of other people involving tremendous suffering has gone on from age to age. Cruelty towards those who are weaker, whether they are women or children, animals or slaves, this has been part of the practice of man also from age to age. And so, this tremendous suffering which we find in the world and which has always existed is man's own responsibility, part of human society. And yet, very few people have inquired as to whether there is not a different way of living, where such suffering does not have to exist, where something of the beauty, the wonder, which we find everywhere in nature, can be reflected. And when people do inquire, try to find out what is the cause, almost no one goes into the root cause. We always attribute the cause to some immediate thing. It is easy when there is a war, which means, as we said, tremendous suffering, to say that it is the fault of the Americans or the Russians, the Arabs or the Jews, the neighbor or whatever it is. Because that is what appears to our immediate perception. And one may be completely mistaken. And by dealing with that immediate cause, perhaps we never deal with the question. If a primitive man heard music issuing from a radio, he may think that the turning of the knob produces the music. The source of the music is in the knob. Later on, he may think that it is in that box-like structure. But it is not. One can go back further and find out the music is not in the transmitting station. It comes from a person who sings. And the music is not in the vocal cords of the individual. The vocal cords by themselves cannot produce music. You have to push further back. So in many cases, the source of the problem or of the happening may not be what one imagines it to be at first. And if we deal with that immediate cause, we deal very inadequately, and that is what has happened always. When there is poverty, it is fairly easy to deal with it by immediately giving some charity. Immediate relief has no doubt to be given. As people are starving in Ethiopia, relief is necessary, but it will not solve the problem, because what leads to that hunger, to that widespread state of poverty, has to be gone into and remedied. So if we try to alleviate suffering by various measures which deal with the symptom and not with the cause, nothing really changes. Man has always found ways of alleviating if he was at all concerned with the question of suffering. So we have orphanages or homes for the destitute. We create new economic theories, political reorganizations are thought of, and so on and so forth. And yet, century after century, the world goes on with the same immense suffering. People on the streets, exploited by others. You know all that happens. So, what is the root cause of suffering? Can there be a total change in the way in which we live and build the environment around us? And this is not a question which can be dismissed by anyone. As we said, even though we may be relatively comfortable at the moment, we cannot be sure that suffering will not come to us very soon in some form or another. The human being seems to have a great aptitude to make a problem of everything and to bring suffering everywhere. In ancient Greece, they spoke about King Midas, whose touch converted everything into gold, which is not such a blessing as one might think. But the human being seems to convert everything into a difficult problem for himself and for others. You know that there have been many reforms, religious, political, economic, but every reform in its turn becomes a problem. Everything becomes corrupt. All religions have become corrupt after a time, because religions have been the cause for dissensions, for fighting, for slaughtering people, for establishing inquisitions, carrying on holy wars, making people frightened of their future life, and so on. And similarly, every economic and political reform has ended in causing suffering. Marx said that when communism was established, the state would wither away. Perhaps that is what he intended should happen, that people should become free and lose their fetters, as he said. But it has not happened. There is tremendous fear there, oppression, concentration camps, political power used to occupy other people's countries, exploit their resources, and so on. So it's always the same story. And one has to inquire and see whether there is something wrong in our very mode of perceiving everything. Because the type of action which anyone engages in is dependent on how he perceives things. In the ancient East, they gave a well-known example of the snake and the rope. When a person sees a snake, he may react in different ways. Perhaps he may get frightened, or he may become violent. He may push others towards the snake in order to make a quicker getaway. He can act in various ways. But if there is a clearer vision and he perceives that what he mistook to be a snake is merely a rope, none of these types of action would be possible. No one will run away from a rope in fright or go forward to kill it. And we all live in realities of our own. We may not accept that fact because every reality appears real, but it may not be so. Everything that we experience seems real at the moment, as is the experience of a person in a dream. The dream may be a frightful one, and while it lasts, the person experiences a great fear. He may even wake up sweating or trembling. And it is only after the experience of the waking state has remained with him for some time that he begins to feel that what happened in the dream was only a dream. And there are many things like that which appear to us to be certainties. And we never question whether they are in fact certainties. We take it for granted that our experience of life and our understanding of how things stand with each other is the correct one and perhaps is the only true perception of things. Even our experience of a subjective nature are liable to be replaced by something different. Because according to our experience is what we call reality. Let us imagine someone who is fairly happy with another person perhaps his wife. But that happiness is broken every now and again by a quarrel or jealousy or frictions of various kinds. He may say, I am on the whole happy. But later, if he is able to experience a happiness which is not broken, which is profounder, which is more stable, then he will say, this is real happiness. The other thing I knew was not real happiness. So one's idea of what is real happiness can change. If you experience a sense of peace, which is superficial, for the time being it seems like peace. But later on, if you are able to move into the dimension of a profounder peace, not easily shaken, not dependent on other people as the previous one was, then you would say that the previous experience was not peace. So our own experience can be replaced by a different reality. And yet, we do not question whether our whole way of perceiving life around us and our way of acting in relation to others is based upon something true or whether it is some kind of unreality out of which we could wake up if we wanted to. There are many things which appear to be us to be absolutely clear. But science now has proved that what we experience with our senses and comprehend with our minds are not as we see them. The reality may be something quite different. And we all experience a sense of separateness. Everything in the world seems to be classified, and each seems to have its own interests and its own advantages. This is how the world appears to us. In the present day, of course, again, many scientists are beginning to realize that there is not that kind of division between things that we imagine to be. The whole world, this earth, seems to be interlinked, and so great is the connection between all things that some scientists speak of the earth as one entity. They say it behaves like a single organism. When one looks at any particular organ of the physical body, that organ is a perfect thing in itself. There is, every atom is a system in itself, self-contained in many ways, perfectly planned, with a beauty of its own. Every cell in the body is a system in itself. But its function is part of a greater system, which is the organ of which it is a part. If we take the organ of sight, the eye, it is a marvelous thing. It has so many intricacies to it. But every atom within it is a marvel. And all those atoms and molecules form part of the eye, which fulfills its own function. But the function of the eye itself is part of the greater system, which is the physical body. But we think this body, this mind which functions through the brain in the body, is a system separate with a purpose of its own, interests which it has to prosecute at the expense of everything else, and achievements which it can acquire to its credit. That entire view of life may be completely wrong. It is as if there were, if there could be life separately in the eye or in the units of matter which compose the eye, and each of them thought that they had their own separate interests, they would be completely mistaken. Perhaps they do think like that, but in fact they are not. They are part of a larger whole. So our whole vision of life may be wrong. It may be not perception, but a form of blindness. And this is what the teachers of yoga spoke about. Yoga is a word which is much misunderstood and devalued in the present day. But one of the fundamental teachings of yoga is that unless we are careful, the mind becomes clouded and loses its capacity to see properly. It begins to think that what it sees is the reality, is truth. And because it indulges in that sense of confidence in its own perceptions, it never sees further. But if it began to question its own perceptions, then it could perhaps open a window towards a different awareness, a different dimension of reality. And because we think that each person is a separate entity, we create a great number of problems. And we do not question what is this thing that seems separate. To each one, the I, the self, seems absolutely real. And this is the one thing which he will never question. But what is this I, which each one may be afraid of losing? Is there really something which can be called the self? There is, of course, the physical body with its functions, its characteristics. It may be tall or short, dark or fair. Whatever it is, the physical body is there. But I don't think many of us would accept that we are only the physical body. If we were only the physical body, they would be like than any other form of matter. The rock, the clod upon the earth would then be the same as ourselves. So it is not the physical body that we consider to be the self. Although an image we conceive in our mind, which is based upon the physical appearance, has a place in that concept of self. But if we examine this notion, which plays so great a part in our lives and creates all the problems we get into, we will find that the self is in fact nothing. It is nothing more than a thought pattern, an image in the mind. If we were to use a theosophical term, we can say it is a thought form, a strong one. It is based, as we said, partly upon the characteristics of the physical body. And it is also partly made up of memories which of various things which have happened. So if we think of the self, we remember who the parents were, what happened in childhood, some incidents which may have taken place, our pleasure or displeasure in respect of those incidents, and we sum up all that memory in one image which we call the self. But it is as ephemeral as any other thought from a certain point of view, except that we have made it a reality for ourselves. And we continually build in to strengthen that self. Most people feel very disturbed when the image they have created, the thought form they have built up, is questioned. So when a person thinks of himself as important and somebody else does not behave as if he recognizes that importance, it creates a great disturbance. Why should one be disturbed because someone else does not recognize importance? If the importance is real, it is there whether others recognize it or not. But because of uncertainty with regard to that importance, there is the constant need to have others support that idea. Therefore, the person who is important considers himself important, is constantly seeking the various signs, outward signs from others, which will convince him still more of that importance. So each one is trying to bolster up his own image of the self, which can fluctuate, which can change, which can have general concepts such as I am important, I am learned, I am beautiful, and so on. And when that thought is there, according to that thought, there are the outward going movements to acquire or to repel. It is this image which tosses the individual in different directions. Because if in that image there is a memory of pleasure and of some object which has given pleasure, then there is the search for further pleasure of this sort. There is the pursuit of similar objects. But on the contrary, if there has been pain, there is the desire to avoid that pain. And so, life is a continual system of attractions and repulsions. And everyone is conditioned to think by the people around him that certain things will bring him pleasure and comfort, and other things will bring him the opposite. Everyone is taught, for example, that if he identifies himself with his nation, with his community, with his family, then there is a greater security in obtaining the comforts and the pleasures which he wants. That is why nationalism, for example, becomes such an important thing. There in nature itself, there are no political divisions. There are mountains and rivers. There is a vast variety of creatures and a variety of human beings also. But nothing in nature compels one to create these divisions which we have done. The political divisions are the creations of the human mind. Nationalism is a conditioning which all of us have more or less acquired, which makes us feel more important and secure than we would if we were just individuals by ourselves. So when the individual feels unimportant and puny, he seeks to make himself important by thinking that he belongs to a nation which is very great, powerful, cultured, or whatever it is. So, on the basis of that image which each one calls his self, there is the activity which takes place. Attachments to certain pleasures. And attachment is the cause of the greatest suffering. Because when we attach ourselves, we have expectations. We have fears, both individually and as a community or as a nation. When a person attaches himself to another person, if that person were to die, it seems to be a tremendous loss. This is one of the important questions which arises in considering the subject of suffering. There is the suffering all over the world of millions of people through the ages. It is very rarely that a person asks, why should there be this suffering, as we mentioned earlier. But when suffering comes to the individual himself, he thinks it is of tremendous importance. Why is it that we consider that personal suffering so important and the general suffering of no importance at all? If both are suffering, in both cases the same thing happens. But it is only because we have always thought that the self is the most important thing. It is the reality which matters most to us. And we have never questioned whether that self is an actuality, it has any importance or not. If we look at nature, we find that nature is abundantly creative, prolific in creating the forms. The forms, the bodies arise, they depart. And everything goes on. But we think in our particular position that our existence, our particular persons, our organism is of tremendous importance, because that is just a thought that one has. But perhaps in the individual, in that sense, the organism, the individual organism, has no great importance. Nature may have a different purpose. They say from the evolutionary point of view that death is a very important thing. It is in fact a marvelous thing. If there were no death of organisms, there would be no evolution at all, because change would take place so very slowly that it could hardly be called change. So the organisms have to change, and death is part of that change. But we do not accept that, because our memory pattern, our thought pattern, includes the characteristics of this particular body, its memories, its experiences. That is the self. And we have created importance for that self. So it is part of our reality, which is not in fact a reality, to think that suffering comes to the self. But actually, suffering does not come to the self. The self itself is suffering. It is the root of suffering. It is what creates the sense of division, the desires, the passions, the struggles. It is the self which is competitive in order to get things for itself. And its whole mode of action is productive of suffering. This is the most important thing to understand. If we look at the teachings of the great religions or the religious teachers, Jesus Christ or Buddha or some other great persons who have lived upon the earth, they did not spend their time in trying to teach people how to cope with the symptoms of suffering, to create new systems, and so on. What they spoke about was to change one's own way of thinking, one's condition of heart, so that in that condition there would be no self and not self-importance. So pride, for example, has been condemned by every religious teaching. Humility, on the other hand, has been eulogized, because if there is true humility, it means that this thought, which is self, is dissolving. And when there is the absence of the self, then there can be a realization that in fact there is an undivided life. We spoke about the fact that everything is interlinked. It is part of one great being. It is a fallacy to think that there are innumerable beings with separate interests. But we are unable to perceive that greater reality, because we are so enamored with this thought of the self. So the thought of the self, this structure which we have created with the mind, has to dissolve. And only then there can be a different awareness of life, which can bring about a different kind of activity. If one were aware of the fact that all things have a shared interest that no one's progress is of greater importance than another. Nobody's well-being is paramount in comparison to others. Then every one of the problems we have can really be solved. But it is that which human beings do not work upon. And to work upon it involves self-knowledge. It involves giving attention to this one thing which looms large upon our minds, which we take for granted as being absolutely real. When we take for granted that there is a world of matter which is absolutely solid, even then we may be wrong, because scientists tell us that what appears as matter is really energy. So what appears to us to be absolutely real may not be real. And it is only when we question the reality in which we tend to live that a greater reality will open up before us, and the possibility of a different type of action which is not productive of suffering will open up before us. The great mystics of the world have all pointed to the fact that there is a different dimension of consciousness where you see the entire world in a different way. And in that dimension which they have experienced, there is extraordinary significance and beauty in all of life, not merely in certain chosen things. There is beauty in every little grain of matter, as many of them have pointed out, in every point of space. But that kind of different vision of existence cannot come as long as the self is so predominant. And therefore, in ancient days they said, where the self is, the universe cannot be. Where the self is, the truth cannot be seen. So to have a freedom from suffering means to understand how we regard ourselves, to see the falsity of our own concept of ourselves and our relationship to the universe. And this possibility is open to human beings, because the one thing which distinguishes the human being from most other creatures is his capacity for self-awareness and self-knowledge. But he has not proceeded very far in that self-knowledge. There are people who have tremendous knowledge of the outer universe, but they are like babies when it comes to understanding what passes in their own minds. And they have no skill at all in creating happiness around themselves, in freeing themselves from suffering. So it is not by observing the outer world that there can be freedom from suffering, but through understanding the inner world of the mind and the falsity of the self which the thought has constructed, that there can be freedom from suffering.
Thank you, Mrs. Brunier. You have given us a lot of ideas to think about.
Should you be interested, Mrs. Rada Bernier has recorded several more interesting talks. One is The Future is Here, given on the 17th of March 1985 at Arewa. Another one, Practical Theosophy, and again, The Secret of Self-Realization. The third one, Paradoxes of Spiritual Life. All these lectures are on cassette and can be obtained from the Theosophical Cassette Centre Library in 13 Balmain Road, Birkenhead.